Welcome back to Technotopia, the podcast about a better future. I'm John Biggs. Today on the show, we have John Sundman. He's a writer and fireman. This is Technotopia.
As I built out Technotopia, I found myself with a problem. There were not enough hours in the day. I had to write, edit, book, and schedule these podcasts, and it ended up taking more time than actually thinking about them and recording them. Then I found Finn, and I fell in love. Finn is a high-quality, on-demand assistant that takes care of the little things. It can book tickets, it can buy gifts, it can schedule events, and it can even build a website or perform market research for you. It's a black box. You put in requests, and you get out real, usable product. What can Finn do? Well, Finn knows your preferences. It remembers the people you interact with and integrates with your email and calendar. Finn can make calls and send emails on your behalf. It can pay bills. It can remember important dates, which I absolutely need. And it just gets things done for you. These features alone have saved me 20 hours per week. Finn is always available on demand, and you only pay for what you use. Once you try Finn just like me, you're going to love it as much as I do. And as a listener of my show, I've arranged for all of you to try Finn for free. Finn.com/techno. That's Finn.com/techno and try Finn for free. Finn has saved me hours. I want you to try it out and tell me what you think. Finn.com/techno, and thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Technotopia, the podcast about a better future. I'm John Biggs. Today on the show, we have national treasure, John Sundman, author, thinker, firefighter for a brief period.
What? 10 years.
10 years.
Now retired.
So you're like the Charles Bukowski of sci-fi, right?
Well, I'm not a drunk. I hope I'm not.
Yeah. All right, welcome, John. This has been it's been a long time coming, really.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Glad to be here.
All right, so we had you on as one of the first Technotopias. I remember this was a while ago, but what's been going on since then?
Well, I've been working on a book since the dawn of time, which should be coming out soon. In my own private life, though, all kinds of personal health catastrophes for my family members, but they've all seemed to be on the mend now, so knock wood.
Okay.
But that's eaten up a lot of time just being a caregiver. But I also have worked construction, as you know. I've been a firefighter, and that wrapped up recently. And now I'm just trying to be a full-time writer.
Do writers have to do what you've done?
I think most. I mean, most writers have to find some other
job.
They don't have to do jobs involving physical labor, you know, but it'd be nice to have a gig as a university professor, I guess, but.
Yeah, we could probably set that up. We'll get you over to NYU and we'll just sneak you in somehow.
All right. Can I do it remotely from Martha's Vineyard?
You go in as a construction guy and then just kind of sneak your way into the journalism department or something. All right. Tell us about Acts of Apostles first. If people haven't read this. You did a lot of stuff in that book. You basically predicted CRISPR. You basically predicted bioengineering. You predicted a lot of the social media stuff. Is all that stuff still coming true?
Yeah, a lot of. So Acts of the Apostles is a thriller, kind of like a Michael Crichton straight ahead near future thriller that I published in 1999, and so it's nearly 20 years old. And in it, I set out to write a murder mystery, and I was talking to a buddy of mine who was a chip designer who couldn't figure out why the chip wouldn't compile, and so I asked him, I know how to put a Trojan horse into software. Could somebody put a Trojan horse in your hardware and you don't know about it? And he said, there's 200,000 transistors on that chip. You could hide the Titanic in there, and I wouldn't know it. So that gave me a plot for a murder mystery. A chip designer discovers a Trojan horse in his chip, and he gets murdered. And so then I had to figure out, why would somebody go to all the trouble of putting a Trojan horse in hardware when it's so much easier to do it in software? And I wound up inventing nanobots to arrange to do brain hacking by DNA editing, and based on a bacteriophage model. So I just threw the whole kitchen sink just trying to solve a murder mystery. I ended up writing a science fiction novel. And
did you start with science fiction? Were you always a science fiction writer?
No. I was never never much. I just read the standard science fiction classics, but I didn't grow up as a science fiction geek. And I kind of accidentally became a science fiction novelist. And then I started going to SF cons like Arisia and Boston and Boscone and a few others like that. And I found out how woefully deficient was my background in science fiction. It was kind of embarrassing. I'd be on a panel with a bunch of other writers, and they would mention a book, and everybody in the audience would know the book and could basically recite it, and I had never heard of it. So,
is that absolutely necessary to have that kind of deep understanding of the fandom to write anything?
No, it's not. It was just interesting. Mm-hmm. As somebody said to me once, that people who attend the science fiction conventions are not typical people who read science fiction. They're typical people who attend science fiction conventions. Right? So, but it is interesting to meet people who are so such serious readers who read so attentively, and they really keep you honest, keep you on your toes. Mm-hmm. So I enjoy that. But no, I'm still not a big science fiction reader. I read science fiction from time to time, but I read lots of other stuff, mm-hmm. like your own bad book.
Oh yeah, my horrible book. Yeah, you reviewed that for me, and you pointed out all the failures that
I said 58 nice things and one or two little you know opportunities for improvement.
Look, actually, I do need to improve that book. I need to go through it again. This is about Marie Antoinette's watch, and I remember like distinctly. I'm there's all kinds of awful stuff in there that I need to fix, but I just can't go back.
No,
can't
you
bring
can't.
Myself.
Yeah, you can't. You can't do. You got to keep moving ahead.
Just let the baby grow into an old age. So, what's the new book about?
Well, the new book is a prequel to Acts of the Apostles. Acts of the Apostles is set in 1995 or so. That's where most of the action takes place. And in it, there are a bunch of most of the characters are either computer engineers or biologists, molecular biologists, and the main characters in the book are in their 30s when we meet them, and the reader finds out in passing that they all had experiences with the arch villain of the book when they were teenagers. So the new book called Mountain of Devils tells that story. It's the prequel 20 years before Acts of the Apostles, when this evil genius Stanford professor gets his hooks into some budding young scientists and starts messing with their minds.
Okay, so you've written you've essentially defined some of the future. What's the rest of the future going to look like? What's the next book going to look like?
Well, the next book I'm working on is called Creation Science, mm-hmm. and I've been working on that since the dawn of time also, but that addresses all meanings of the phrase creation science. So it's creationism and the science of where creativity comes from, and anything else that could go along with that phrase. And it's kind of like a very surreal Thomas Pynchon kind of story set on a lot of it set on the uninhabited island called No Man's Land, mm-hmm. off of Martha's Vineyard. So I'll tell you more about that book later. But what's happening coming in the future, gosh, I wish I know. That, I mean, obviously the climate crisis has now become so obvious that nobody, except for the militantly ignorant, could ignore
awful,
it.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, people have been talking about it since the 1980s, and it's been possible to pretend that it wasn't here, or wasn't happening. Mm-hmm. It was sometime in the future, but now I don't think any thoughtful person can maintain that anymore.
Can we be hopeful in the face of that kind of global tragedy?
Yeah. Yeah, we still can. There's still time, I think. I have a good friend, Tom Athanasou, who has been writing about the climate crisis for 30 years. His first book was called Divided Planet, and that came out, 1990 or so. And his thesis was that the technological solutions to the climate crisis exist and have always existed. Mm-hmm. What's necessary, though, is a framework that addresses the needs of the billions of people in the poor parts of the earth, generally called the global south. And so the problem is not the technological one about how to get carbon out of the air and so forth. It's a social justice one, how to do this in a way that is acceptable to people who have nothing now, the people who are very, very poor around the earth. If you and I produce, umpteen tons of carbon to maintain our consumerist North American lifestyle, it's hard for us to tell the people, you know, living on a dollar a week in sub-Saharan Africa that they have to remain poor for the rest of their lives because the carbon equation or carbon balance of the world requires it. So we have to find an equitable solution that addresses the needs of all the people of the earth, not just the wealthy people. And I'm hopeful that we can. There's still time to do that. I mean, not much, but there is. We're not dead yet. No. You know?
I mean, I guess that's the historic. I was talking with somebody over the week. He lives in Sagatuck, and he's seen many things come and go, basically. And the idea that these moments in history are not the end of history, right? We had violence in the 60s, we had wars, we had poverty in the 70s, and things basically just righted themselves. And can think, what does it take for the average person to right these things? Or should they just sit back and just wait for things to happen?
No, they shouldn't sit back and wait for things to happen. Absolutely not. It's a real crisis we have. I mean, civilization itself really is at risk of just disappearing. I mean, if you were living in Germany in 1945, it looked like the world was ending. But it didn't look that way in Chicago. There were local pockets where the world was ending. If you were living in Vietnam in 1968, it looked like the world was ending. But now it's the entire earth that's under threat. If you're talking about looking out 20 years and Singapore's underwater, New York City's underwater, Rio de Janeiro's underwater, there's going to be no more effective global governments. It's just going to be chaos and who knows what. So it's urgent. But I think that the solution has to be, first of all, we have to have reasonable people in our government, which we don't seem to have now. So that's the first step. And then I don't know how to address the problem of getting people to abandon magical thinking and adopt logical thinking. Mm-hmm. That is a big conundrum.
Is it a generational thing? Everybody likes to blame the baby boomers on this stuff.
No, I don't think it's I'm a baby boomer, right? My generation has totally fucked up everything.
I also want to get your understanding on it because it's important for me because I watched my dad, for example. He degraded into basically just listening to Rush Limbaugh and watching Fox News and doing stuff that was designed kind of just to piss me off he did it primarily to get attention, I guess, because nobody was paying attention to him. He worked in the government for 30 years, he retired, laid down on the sofa, then lay down on the floor, and then sat down in a wheelchair, and that was his retirement. Yeah. And that's like the worst case scenario. You're obviously doing construction and being a fireman and writing amazing books, so it's an entirely different animal. But I would argue that the vast majority of every generation ends up more like my dad, ultimately, and my generation is the same way, that they end up more than my dad, but they also have this special... the extra little kicks that they got from the perks that they got, GI Bill, socioeconomic growth that was consistent and wage growth that was consistent, the ability to graduate high school and get a good job and buy a boat and a pool and everything. Are those benefits coming home to roost? Is that something?
Well, yeah, I think that's part of it. And I think there has always been, just part of human nature, there's always a temptation to magical thinking. Mm-hmm. And actually, in the history of civilization, the idea of science it came along with the Enlightenment. It hasn't been around for that long. Right? And so if you look at people today who are anti-vaxxers, and people who believe in all kinds of bizarre conspiracy theories and who join cults, it just seems to be a temptation that people fall into because... if you get into a cocoon where you have a certain set of beliefs that you believe protect you from the realities of the world, that's my analysis anyway. Mm-hmm. People turn to religion for a bunch of reasons, but I think the number one is fear of death. And I was at the Brooklyn Museum yesterday, and I was looking at the Egyptian rooms with their preoccupation with death and how to avoid it. I mean, so much of their art, so much of their civilization was based on the what happens to you after you die and how to make sure you don't die. And then you go up to the Renaissance art, and it's all pictures of Christ and the crucifix and the resurrection and what to do to make sure you don't die. Mm-hmm. And it's just like this, you know, and it seems like once you accept the idea that you're going to die and there is no end of it, I mean, that there's no escape from that, then, you know, you can free up all kinds of other resources to think about sex or whatever. Mm-hmm. but I'm rambling on. But I think that there is a, you know, people get older sometimes and they get set in their ways and they become more, you know, ensconced, is that a word, in their own bubble, like you describe your father.
Yep.
But I think, you know, it's a danger for young people too. There are people out there who become sclerotic. They become set in their ways at a very early age. And like I said, the phenomenon of anti-vax, you know, not believing in vaccines, mm-hmm. is really upsetting. It's a brutal to innocent children. It gets children. It causes them to suffer under diseases they don't need to suffer under. It causes some of them to die, and I think that's related to the anti-GMO movement. And you know, I'm very skeptical of large agribusiness companies, but I'm not skeptical about science, mm-hmm. right? And so. Or science is a job. I know that science isn't a perfect institution, sure, sure. or whatever, but when people espouse the idea of non-GMO on their food as if it's some kind of magical something or other power to prevent evil from coming through their food, and you know, if you look at the number of people in the world who don't get enough to eat, right, or don't have enough good, healthy food to eat, GMO crops could be lifesavers for them. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's this knee-jerk, non-rational rejection of it is I don't know. I get on my hobby horse here, but it's upsetting to me.
No, I understand. I mean, it seems like it is the magical thinking. It's the idea of magical thinking where you have some technology that could feasibly improve a very natural thing. The expectation that crops should be natural has gone the way of the dodo. I mean, it hasn't been natural since the end of hunter gatherer. Mm-hmm. Right, we've done GMO to plants for centuries.
Well, now the main thing is that we understand how DNA works. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't understand everything about how, sure, DNA works, but basically ever since Watson and Crick, you know, mm-hmm. elucidated the structure, we say, okay, now we have a basic model to work from.
Yep.
And once you understand that, you understand that DNA is DNA. There's no magical naturalness to DNA. Whether you build it molecule by molecule in a silicon DNA foundry, or whether it's inherited from another crop, it's still the same molecule.
What does your world look like in 20 years?
Oh. Assuming I'm still here.
You'll be hanging out.
Well, yeah. I am a avuncular, successful novelist. And I'm kind of like the Terry Pratchett. And people regard me as not a Norman Mailer or Philip Roth kind of crank. But, I don't know. And I'm still healthy. I'm still lifting weights.
Does technology help that, or is that just you going to lift weights?
I don't know how to say it, because, you know, I don't even know how to use half the stuff on my cell phone. So, I mean, I understand how cell phone operating systems mm-hmm. work, I don't know where technology fits into that, other than I think there's going to be some really, really interesting applications of things like virtual reality and augmented reality to deal with the climate crisis. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's hope that all this weaponization, as they say, of the information wars kind of stuff, that doesn't destroy us. So there's just so many open-ended areas that it's hard to say. Mm-hmm. But I do think that the main challenge is going to be, can we get our act together as a species to deal with the climate crisis? That's the existential question.
Does it seem like we've hit a period of more unknowns than knowns, or has it always been this way?
That's a hard one.
Mm-hmm.
I You know, if you looked at the worldview of the Renaissance people, they thought there were like seven big questions. And if you talk to a scientist, philosopher today, they'll say there's 9 billion, mm-hmm. 600 million big questions. So in that sense, the more we know, the more we know we don't know, I guess. But in terms of what any individual is trying to accomplish in their life, they want to have meaningful friendships. They want to have a roof over their head. They want to have fun, you know. So some of those things are just perennial, mm-hmm. I think.
Okay.
But if new forms of sentience come into being where cyborgs are, you know, linked over the internet and they're, you know, new whole forms of being that we don't even have any philosophy to address, that, you know.
That's it. That is a good question. Does philosophy still work in this age? Does philosophy, in an era when we understand a lot of what the brain is doing, even down to dreams, etc., do liberal arts and philosophy have anything to bring anything to the table anymore?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the whole liberal arts idea is that you learn how to learn. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not the subject matter per se as much as it is the figuring out how to harness curiosity and maintain curiosity. I think that, I hope that philosophy is still relevant in terms of figuring out what's important versus what isn't important, how to know whether you're bullshitting yourself, mm-hmm. how to maintain skepticism without falling into cynicism. So I think those are things that philosophy is good for, I hope.
I mean, a lot of people are saying that that's basically one of the Facebook's primary problems and social media's primary problems, that the idea... I just wrote recently that the idea of user-generated content, that was kind of a zines and punk music, yep. and all that stuff. That was supposed to be first thought, best thought, and went all the way back to the Beats. And that same idea is what drives current social media. And at that point, we're commoditizing and commercializing it so much that that's first thought, best thought is now the only thought. It's the only... Are we losing something in that process?
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, as a guy who writes novels, mm-hmm. right? If you're trying to sell novels to people who seldom read anything longer than a tweet, you know, that is that's a difficult proposition. And I wonder if I'm just like, you know, building buggy whips for a living or something. but I do think that I hope that there are some people out there who can sustain complex thoughts, you know. Like, for example, a thought that persists over a 400-page novel. Mm-hmm. You know, I hope that we're not just becoming stupider and stupider, although, you know, when you look at our current administration and, you know, maybe...
There's a reason why this podcast is 25 minutes and yeah. not, like, 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
I would love to sit here for 2.5 hours and chat with people, but mm-hmm. it just doesn't... I don't feel that it's fair to take somebody's life for 25 minutes and have them sit and listen to... two dudes talk about philosophy, and it's fascinating stuff. Obviously, yeah. we get some good stuff out of it, but it's interesting. I have a weird way of thinking about this user-generated content that I think it was bad. I think it was a bad idea.
Yeah.
But the genie's out of the bottle. How do we change it?
Yeah. So what's your opinion?
Well, this is about you, but the idea is that what myself and my cohorts, all the early bloggers, the Gawker kids, did was they basically just tore through the entire media industry in the early 2000s. And we tore down every single thing, everything institution. We tore down the idea that you have to sit there and you have to call three people before you can write the story.
Right.
We tore down the idea that embargoes were important, et cetera, et cetera. And we basically ripped up, in terms of Gizmodo, we ripped up tech journalism in case of Wonkette. These other sites, we ripped up political journalism. And what we have now is all the chickens coming home to roost.
Yeah.
And that's if I'm going to be cynical about any aspect of the future, and this is a podcast about technotopia, it's about utopian vision of the future. If I'm going to be cynical about that, it's that. It's the idea that we tore up institutions that were designed to safeguard us, for better or worse, from garbage, really.
Yeah. Well, I think in terms of institutions, are we wrapping up here? I think in terms of institutions that are... what am I trying to say? I'm thinking about the United States Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the retrograde, anti-science, closed-minded view of the world, it's the current, you know, white, male, wealthy people who are not representative of the United States population in general. I mean, certainly the gender-wise, the Senate isn't representative. Race-wise, color-wise, however you want to say it, it's not representative. And the arrogance of those people is just mind-boggling, that you would have sitting senators telling scientists that they know more about climate science than they do, mm-hmm. by virtue of, I don't know what, by virtue of having been in the Senate for 40 years.
Yeah,
you know, where does that arrogance come from? Where does that sense that they know? And a lot of it is built into a religious sensibility, a sense that, you know, I know because the Bible tells me so. Mm-hmm. And I really find that upsetting. You know, did you see the piece in the New York Sunday Times magazine yesterday? The whole issue was dedicated to the climate crisis. Mm-hmm. The Times put it online on Wednesday, and it was published as a magazine yesterday. And it's the whole issue is about the climate crisis. Mm-hmm. And I was reading a critique of the article by Naomi Klein, and she made a couple of interesting points, because the guy who wrote the article, his name was Nathaniel Rich. He comes to the conclusion that in the 1980s, the science was pretty much settled and the opportunities were there to address the problem, but we didn't. And he says the reason is because human nature just wants us to focus on the short-term things at hand and not look ahead to things that are 30, 40, 50 years off. And I just don't think that's right. I think that if you look, and Naomi Klein makes a compelling case, that no, there are lots of other things. Like, that's when Reaganism and Thatcherism were in the ascendancy, and the whole neoliberal agenda, the whole thing that said your individual actions are what matter, not institutions, not the common good. There is no such thing as the common good in a libertarian point of view. There's only your individual advancement, mm-hmm. and any common good is a side effect of all that. So that was the agenda that pretty much rejected the whole idea of concerted action to address a common problem. And that philosophy is very much still alive, and it's embraced by wealthy, powerful people, mm-hmm. who are in control. It's kind of enraging. So you know, the technological future very much depends on the political future.
Hmm. Hopefully the kids will be a little more civic-minded. Maybe they'll be a little more socialist.
Yeah, I think so. I think so, and I think that there's much more of a global consensus. Younger people, I hope, are if they're living in Sao Paulo, Brazil, or they're living in suburban United States, or in sub-Saharan Africa, they realize that they got more in common with each other and they're facing it than they do with maybe the old farts of their own country, their own culture.
And they're all going to be reading your books.
I hope so. And I hope your listeners are reading my books. And I hope they'll sign up for my newsletter.
I know it. Okay, we got to get you on. We got to get people on your newsletter. What's your website?
Website is johnsundman.com. Mm-hmm. And you can go there and sign up for my Technopotheosis newsletter, which I talk about art, ethics, synthetic biology, construction labor, firefighting, and so forth.
We got to get you on a blog. We'll get you on. We'll get you on a blog somehow.
Good. I appreciate it.
We'll create a little blog for.
I think your readers, your listeners, the technotopian, mm-hmm. kind of people, are my ideal audience.
We'll try to access them. Your new book is coming out when?
It should be ready in October.
All right. Very good. John Sundman, National Treasure. Thank you for joining us on Technotopia.
Thank you for having me, John.
Thanks.
Technotopia is brought to you by Happy Fun Corp. Happy Fun Corp is a design-driven technology company in Brooklyn, New York that specializes in building mobile and web applications for startups and Fortune 500 companies. Whether it's a new mobile or web application that will help people experience the internet in a fun new way, or software that will interface with a new piece of top-secret hardware, Happy Fun Corp is always up to the challenge. Big or small, Happy Fun Corp loves building software and loves working with great people. Come build with them. HappyFunCorp.com.
Technotopia is presented by your host, John Biggs. It was produced by Rick Barr of Bar 26 Entertainment at ricksvoice.com. It appears every Friday at noon, and we're always looking to talk to interesting people. Tweet @JohnBiggs if you'd like to join us on the show.